silence myself.
Okay, would you like a glass of water or a cup of coffee?
A glass of water would be good.
A glass of water?
Thank you so much.
So this will take about 26 minutes.
Yes.
Because when we timed it, it was exactly 25 minutes and 59
yes.
seconds.
Yes. Okay, no, just be mindful. Sit there and don't move. And watch and so far. Oh my goodness. Are you okay? Yes. Zachary, please sit down. Zachary, crush your shadow, Kohen. It'll work. Besides, if it doesn't, I have a very loud voice. Oh yeah, I've done this in project when necessary.
No, you've only done it once.
No, I've given speeches before a lot.
No, you've only read this speech.
Okay,
once.
This speech, this gets its world premiere here.
Wow.
Yeah, so yeah, a nearly 4,000 word presentation.
Yeah, we're
yes, you are.
So,
yes.
This will make it easier, you know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I've been there, done that.
And we have a number of elderly people who are so hearing. That's why we always
absolutely. No.
And you've got a great voice.
Yeah, thank you. I'm
there you go.
I do my best to be mindful of my audience. We are recording this right now, actually, for later presentation. Yes. I set up QuickTime on my laptop, so it'll actually record the audio. See that?
So then it's currently recording?
Yes,
right
yes it is. Yep, everything you say is being recorded. So.
How many megabytes are there?
Already we've recorded 5.2 megabytes.
It's going to be like 2 gigabytes.
No, it's not going to be that big. It'll probably be about 90 megabytes by the time we're done.
Okay. So good morning.
Morning.
I just want to welcome all of you to Forum this morning. And we have a wonderful speaker, Mitch, and I'm not going to say her.
Mitchell Shchepanchik.
Yes. And he is going to be speaking to us on some of the action going on right now regarding the Federal Communications Commission and media. And I think for all of us, this is an incredibly critical issue. And I think we've seen it, especially over the last year, how important it is that we have an independent media. And so I want to welcome you, Mitch. There will be many others that will come in. We always try to get people here at 10 o'clock, but probably by 10:30 you'll have 25 or 30.
That's
I apologize for the start, but I will tell you, these are really important people.
Very much appreciated. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. My name is Mitchell Shchepanchik.
So why don't you come and stand here so you're not
okay.
So far away.
The problem is, two problems. One is I have a 4,000 word speech that I've written for the event. And also,
4,000 words.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it was at about 3,800 words when I applied the word count program on it to count the number of words. That is actually slightly less than what Wolfram Alpha says is a normal speech presentation in a half hour's amount of time. It says about 4,500 spoken words. Mm-hmm. So I get it a little bit just to give it a little bit more slack. So when I was emailed what to present about, the particular focus was not just on media, but in particular on two companies that actually were supposed to merge. In fact, it actually segues to this presentation focusing on two companies, the Tribune Media, along with its ancestors and descendants, as well as Sinclair Broadcast Group. Before I was asked to give this presentation, the two companies were slated to merge. In the just 2 months since then, we now know they are not. They have actually canceled that, and I'm going to explain in this presentation why they will not. But in the course of this presentation, I'm going to give a capsule history on the Tribune with a particular focus on the last two decades. Then I will give a capsule history on Sinclair, and it's nowhere near as old as Tribune. It was founded in 1971, for example. Then I will give a capsule history of their failed attempt to merge, as well as some closing remarks. One point to keep in mind, histories about the politics of media and of media companies like those I'm going to discuss are usually couched in terms of a Game of Thrones, in contexts involving shareholders, lawyers, courts, corporations, markets, capitalism, but certainly not anti-trade riffraff like myself. History often downplays or usually flat out ignores the role that political activists will play in the future histories of these companies, but it bears noting that political activism has played a considerable role in the narrative of these two companies at key points. I will, in this presentation, unlike those other conventional histories, highlight that activism and in the story of these two companies. You'll see why it's very important in the course of this presentation. Regarding the Tribune begins, of course, with the Chicago Tribune newspaper, which was founded back in 1847. Its early history, it actually turned out to be an anti-slavery newspaper, but it also had a streak of xenophobism and ran a lot of xenophobic op-eds. In the late 1850s, the Tribune absorbed three other Chicago newspapers, the Free West, the Democratic Press, and the Chicago Democrat. When people are talking about media concentration, it's not new. Also in the 1850s, the co-founder of the Cleveland Leader newspaper, a man named Joseph Medill, became editor of the Tribune and effectively ran the newspaper on and off for the next 40 years. Medill was later elected mayor of Chicago in 1871. The revolving door between media and politics is not a new thing. In 1911, one of Medill's grandsons, Robert Rutherford McCormick, Colonel McCormick, who actually was a colonel, actually was a field colonel in World War I. So it is not just an honorific. He actually was a colonel. Robert McCormick actually became owner of the Tribune, but he was a grandson of Joseph Medill. Yeah, and so then, you know, nepotism is not a new thing. McCormick, during the next four decades as owner between 1911 and through the mid-1950s, grew the newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, via publicity campaigns such as lotteries, comic strips. The comic strip Little Orphan Annie actually began in the Tribune. The advent of Major League Baseball's All-Star Game and a design competition for Tribune Tower. All of which aligning a political and editorial stance with the old right conservative political perspective. The Tribune also entered the fray later on in the 1920s and 1930s regarding a new medium. It leased out radio station WDAP and took the Tribune's model as the self-proclaimed world's greatest newspaper, taking the initials as a new set of call letters for its station, WGN. Yeah. That's why it's called that.
Sure, we know that.
Tribune entered a political fight to commercialize what had been the first general counsel of the Federal Radio Commission. This was the government predecessor to the Federal Communications Commission, which handled politics and political issues regarding radio. The Tribune's attorney was a man named Lewis Caldwell. And Lewis Caldwell became the first general counsel, basically the lead attorney, for the Federal Radio Commission. He led an effort at the Federal Radio Commission to reallocate radio station time in favor of commercial stations like WGN. That allocation killed off a great many student, community, and nonprofit radio stations that were operating before the 1920s. It then later gave WGN the maximum broadcast strength that was allowed by law, 50,000 watts, a strength that still holds. A battle for American broadcasting, the trajectory of American broadcasting ensued during the late 1920s and early 1930s. But the commercial opposition, with its greater resources and insider political connections, defeated the efforts to make a significant nonprofit presence on radio. Another four decades after that, political ferment in the 1960s and 70s led to the passage of rules that limited the concentration of media in the United States. Tribune was able to avoid some of these media ownership limits as a result of various grandfathering clauses in those laws. These clauses allowed a small number of companies that already held ownership in multiple media outlets in the same vicinity to keep their ownership. As a part of the trend of media consolidation that would ensue after this in the 1980s and the 1990s, the Tribune was able to extend its own reach so that the Tribune, in its own business memoranda, could claim that it could reach 90% of all Chicagoans. As documented by Eric Kleinenberg in his book Fighting for Air, the Tribune, at its peak, could claim a media presence in newspapers with the Chicago Tribune, magazines with Chicago Magazine, television, WGN-TV, radio, WGN-AM, Spanish language media with its ownership in OI, and ownership until about 2000 with the Chicago Cubs baseball team. The Tribune, though, had greater ambitions still. It sought to become a top 10 media company by building out TV newspaper duopolies in America. That is, it would be able to own a TV and a newspaper in the same city. It has achieved a significant step in that direction when in the early 2000s, Tribune bought the Times Mirror newspaper chain, thus gaining a foothold and TV newspaper duopolies in New York, Los Angeles, Baltimore, and Hartford, Connecticut. Tribune got another waiver from the FCC to keep the duopolies in these cities in contravention of those media ownership rules. But extending its growth required changing or abolishing those media ownership rules, the deregulation of the in the parlance of the day. In early 2002 and 2003, with a Republican FCC in the majority, a Republican in the White House, Republicans in commands of both houses of Congress, and Republicans in key roles of the judiciary, Tribune's dream and our collective nightmare was about to come true, except that it didn't. During that year, a grassroots political effort, including those efforts I was involved with the group I'm representing today, Chicago Media Action, those efforts sought to raise attention to the evisceration of the media, remaining media ownership rules in the hope that rousing up enough people to voice opposition to stop the rules. Those efforts were galvanized by the internet and caught a number of lucky breaks, including, ironically enough, coverage by some Republicans, most notably William Sapphire in the New York Times. There were protests in a number of cities, which never happens regarding media policy, another historic first was coverage by the media of its own policy. They very rarely do this, but they did it in this case. The result was that the numbers of people who commented into the FCC broke all records of FCC feedback in the agency's history, and that gained the attention of Congress. Nevertheless, the FCC voted along party lines to eviscerate the rules, but those protests and the swelling awareness fueled lawsuits that ultimately blocked the rule changes and blocked also billions of dollars of pending business transactions regarding media properties. The Tribune and its lobbying efforts to try to undo this fell flat-footed. It now swam uphill to try to reverse the court rulings as well as the beating it got in the court of public opinion. Rather than securing duopolies as it had planned to escalate growth nationwide, the Tribune now faced a parade of judicial defeats. The deflated promises and mixed expectations spurred a shareholder revolt. Tribune shareholders demanded a change of ownership, and they got it. Chicago area real estate tycoon Sam Zell became owner of the Chicago Tribune. Shortly after that happened, the Tribune filed for bankruptcy, became the largest media bankruptcy in American history, in fact. Tribune was mired in bankruptcy for 4 years, after which Tribune was then balkanized, divided into two companies, Tribune Publishing, focusing on print publishing, later renamed with the worst name in media history, Tronc, for Tribune Online Content, but abbreviated T-R-O-N-C, Tronc, and Tribune Media, focusing on radio and television broadcast. Think for a minute on how the mighty Tribune Corporation fell. Activists entered the fray at the right time and caused a block of key plans, leading to a cascade of effects over the next 15 years. The moral is, you are more powerful than you know. Both arms of the former Tribune had sought out buyers. Tribune Publishing had sought a buyer in Gannett before Gannett and Tribune had negotiated and then pulled out of negotiations twice over. And Tribune Media, in early 2017, had successfully courted the largest TV station owner in the United States, a conglomerate based in suburban Baltimore, abbreviated SBG, Sinclair Broadcast Group. About Sinclair, Julian Sinclair Smith was an engineer who owned a radio station in Baltimore. With the expansion of the UHF television band, Julian Sinclair Smith applied for and received a UHF television license and founded a company in 1971 called Chesapeake Television Corporation. By 1986, Julian Sinclair Smith's company grew to a network of three stations, WBFF in Baltimore, and stations each in Pittsburgh and in Columbus, Ohio. In 1993, Julian Sinclair Smith passed away. Control of the family business fell to Julian's four sons, David, Jay Duncan, Robert, and Frederick, who changed the company's name in memory of their father, and Sinclair Broadcast Group was founded. All four Smith brothers still sit on the executive board of Sinclair, but David Smith, who serves as executive chairman, is the driving force of Sinclair. And you can't understand Sinclair's current circumstances and its current positions without understanding David Smith. So let's talk about David Smith. He was the only one of Julian Sinclair Smith's four sons who had any media experience. He helped to establish a television transmitter company, and he also worked as a partner for a company that distributed bootleg videotapes of pornographic films, if you can believe it. The company was called Cine Processors, C-I-N-E accent grave processors. It operated in the basement of one of the buildings that Julian Sinclair Smith owned. Cine Processors was found to have connection with mob politics and was ultimately raided by the police. David Smith's business partner at Cine Processors was quoted as saying, "How David got control of the family company after that, I don't know." In 1996, David Smith was himself then later arrested on suspicion of soliciting prostitution. The solicitation took place in a Mercedes automobile owned by Sinclair. David Smith faced a misdemeanor sex offense and avoided community service work by having Sinclair broadcast announcements of drug counseling programs to fill in his community service requirements. Needless to say, the judge in the case was incensed. "How can employees do community service for their boss?" said the judge. He got away with it anyway. David Smith's politics stand to the right of Attila the Hun. David Smith has been quoted as saying, quote, "The print media is so left-wing as to be meaningless dribble, which accounts for why the industry is and will fade away. Just no credibility," unquote. His rabid right-wing political views, since assuming control of Sinclair, has permeated Sinclair's actions as illustrated by the following examples. Exhibit A. Starting in 2001, Mark Hyman, H-Y-M-A-N, a former Sinclair lobbyist, starting regularly producing one-minute-long conservative commentary pieces under a segment called The Point, which ran for 5 years. Hyman, during an interview on CNN, even went so far as to compare Democrats to, quote, "Holocaust deniers," unquote. Doesn't get better. Exhibit B. Mark Hyman was defending Sinclair's aggressive approach during the 2004 election to re-elect George W. Bush, assuming he was elected in the first place, in promoting his presidency nevertheless, and also opposing Democratic nominee John Kerry to the presidency. Sinclair refused to air an episode of the ABC television program Nightline that listed the names of American soldiers who died in the 2003 war and occupation of Iraq. Exhibit C. In response to this, Sinclair ordered its stations to broadcast an anti-John Kerry documentary called Stolen Honor. The documentary never aired as intended because of a backlash from media activist groups which pressured Sinclair advertisers and caused the decline of Sinclair's stock price. It lost 17% and $105 million of value in just a few days. Exhibit D. An anonymous Sinclair ex-producer reported in Rolling Stone magazine in 2005 that he was ordered to report, quote, "no bad news out of Iraq, no dead servicemen, no reports on how much we're spending, nothing. You weren't reporting news. You were reporting a political agenda that came to you from the top of the food chain. Is any information that doesn't come directly from Sinclair or from the mouth of David Smith himself suspect? Perhaps that's the idea," unquote. During the first decade of the 21st century, Sinclair continued to grow in spite of media consolidation limits that was intended to stop it from growing. The approach, unfortunately, was maddeningly simple. Sinclair employees or relatives of employees would buy a TV station, particularly in a city where Sinclair already owned a TV station, and simply transfer the license to Sinclair after the purchase was complete. This approach even has a name. They're called sidecar agreements. Even when Sinclair got caught, as happened in 2001 when the FCC caught them and leveled a $40,000 fine, Sinclair got to keep the stations. Once it owns a station, Sinclair then cuts staff, sometimes by as much as 80% from the station, and produces programs from a single centralized office in Maryland called News Central that's made to look like a local TV outlet, but without disclosing the fact that it's not produced locally. Sinclair took a serious financial hit in the Great Recession during the early years of the Obama administration, and even flirted with possible bankruptcy. Sinclair's financial prospects brightened after 2010 when the Supreme Court ruled to upend campaign finance limitations in the ironically named Citizens United ruling. It's important to note that upwards of 70% of the funds that are spent in political campaigns for elections and re-elections in the United States are used to buy television advertisements. That's the reason why they're so expensive. Most of the money is used to pay these TV ads. It was also during the Obama years that Sinclair faced a more stringent policy crackdown from the FCC. Then FCC Chair Tom Wheeler looked to change rules that Sinclair exploited. It wanted to change the rule that allowed UHF stations to divide their audience count by half, thus making it seem that their audience was actually smaller than was actually the case, as well as the FCC's policies in allowing sidecar agreements where licensees could easily transfer from employees or relatives to larger conglomerates. But with the Trump administration and a Republican majority at the FCC since 2016, that crackdown became passé. Ajit Pai, who became chair of the FCC in the Trump administration, and within weeks of becoming chair, abolished the sidecar agreement rules, and within months after becoming chair, the FCC voted to restore the aforementioned audience discount on UHF stations. It was also in Trump that Sinclair doubled down on its right-wing politics. Adding to Mark Hyman, Sinclair stations now include regular commentary from Boris Epstein, a former Trump administration official whose role was assistant director of communications and who now serves as Sinclair's chief political analyst. Boris Epstein was described by one commenter from the group Media Matters for America, who watched nearly 300 of his clips and commentary under the presentation Bottom Line with Boris, commented as follows, quote, Boris displays untold levels of ignorance and political obtuseness, along with a lack of charisma I cannot accurately convey with words. Unquote. Epstein, among other things, defended Trump's both sides line, giving political cover to Nazis. He played down Trump's family separation policy, attacked politician Maxine Waters, as well as NFL players who protest during the national anthem. One columnist for the Baltimore Sun described these segments as, quote, close to classic propaganda as anything I have seen in broadcast television in the last 30 years. And yet there's still more. Sinclair now has a segment called the Terrorism Alert Desk. It's little more than a fear and a panic-inducing segment that none too suddenly, among other things, equates the whole faith of Islam with terrorism. Sinclair also bought a national mobile news aggregation app called Circa, which gives Sinclair a text-based news service which frequently trumpets Trump's agenda of the day. And on top of all of this, employees at Sinclair have complained of dismal working conditions and contracts. A number of anonymous Sinclair employees wrote an anonymous op-ed for the website Vox. They said that employees have to put up with forced arbitration, a six-month non-compete clause upon leaving, and if you are a Sinclair employee and you quit, you can face financial penalties equal to 40% of your annual salary. Then there's the sexual harassment issue. Luane Canipe, former Sinclair employee, described it as follows, quote, let's just say there was a sexual atmosphere that trickled down to different levels in the company. There was an improper work environment. I think that's because of what David Smith did, what I described earlier. And there was a feeling that everything was fair game, unquote. So that's Sinclair in a nutshell, a massive conglomerate run by a right-wing crackpot and erstwhile pornography distributor whose sexism runs rampant within the company and whose personal politics run rampant on American television sets, who is assisted by a bonehead chief political analyst. Media critic Jay Rosen describes Sinclair as a new kind of media company, a political empire with television stations. How big is Sinclair? According to Sinclair's own business website, Sinclair owns 191 television stations and broadcasts 601 television channels in 89 markets across America. Sinclair stations includes affiliates with ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, The CW, MyTV, and Univision. Sinclair's aggregate broadcast reach encompasses 40% of all American households. The current FCC limit, by the way, is 39%. Sinclair's reported revenue in the year 2017 came to $2.7 billion. And into all of this, we bring the Tribune. In February 2017, Sinclair announced it would purchase Tribune Media and its 42 additional television stations for $3.9 billion. The broadcast footprint of Sinclair, had this gone through, would have escalated from 40% of reach of all Americans to an estimated 72% of all Americans. Before the purchase, Sinclair had just one television station in America's top 10 most populous cities. After the purchase, Sinclair would have had seven stations in America's 10 most populous cities. But as I mentioned at the outset, the deal is dead. What happened? As with the media ownership uprising of 2003 that demolished Tribune's dreams to grow, people first in small groups, then in larger formations, began to organize and speak out. In the case of the uprising of 2003, that crystallization was largely new and largely unexpected, even among media activists. I certainly didn't see it coming. But it has since, in recent years, become faster and easier to organize. Also, a number of lucky breaks came along to help the campaign. For the Sinclair proposed buyout of Tribune, that came in April 2018. Media producer Timothy Burke wrote an article for Deadspin headlined, "How I Made a Dumb Video Making Fun of Sinclair Broadcasting and Somehow Started a Media War," unquote. The video he's referring to shows a number of broadcasts from Sinclair-owned TV stations synced in parallel, side by side on the screen, all reading the same script. The effect is eerie, but the video that he made went viral and has been seen more than 200,000 times on YouTube, garnered a host of follow-up coverage, was actually even broadcast on Sinclair stations when a media watch group called Allied Progress paid for airtime on Sinclair stations to show an ad that excerpted that Deadspin video. The coverage also extended to a larger segment on the HBO television show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, which critiqued Sinclair and its history and garnered another multi-million person audience. In July 2018, the FCC announced that it would be referring the proposed Sinclair Tribune merger to an administrative judge. In practical terms, this meant that the FCC was going to kill the merger. It cited in its decision that Sinclair's shady sidecar agreements that Ajit Pai and the FCC were looking to approve. The same day Sinclair called off the merger, Tribune proceeded to file a $1 billion lawsuit against Sinclair, citing a breach of contract. So Tribune that was supposed to get bought out is now suing its erstwhile proposed future parent for $1 billion, corporate parent. The activist Kevin Danaher says that all political struggles boil down to just four words: unite friends, divide enemies. In this case, Tribune and Sinclair, which were very nearly united, are now very much divided and will be fighting in court for a while. In the case of Tribune and Sinclair, popular forces successfully united friends and divided enemies. But so what does the future hold for Sinclair and for Tribune? Tribune Media is still looking for a buyer and is continuing to vet potential suitors. Sinclair is reportedly trying to establish its own version of Fox News. It would be a cable TV network with a blatant right-wing perspective that would be owned by Sinclair outright and be a rival. Sinclair announced in July that it was establishing its own streaming news app called Stir, S-T-I-R-R, which could serve as a launching pad for that rival cable news network. One thing, though, has changed, irreparably so for Sinclair. People know about Sinclair, and I'm not talking about media activists like myself. Sinclair is now a household name with a degree of infamy, and that's something that Sinclair cannot take back, and if history is any guide, that will matter going forward. To get a glimpse of what the future may hold for Sinclair, it may be illustrative to look at the past for what happened to another right-wing media conglomerate, the former Clear Channel Communications. Remember these folks? Clear Channel is parallel to Sinclair in a number of ways. Like Sinclair, Clear Channel was a mom-and-pop media operation run by the Mays family of San Antonio, Texas. Like Sinclair, Clear Channel was the beneficiary of media ownership rule changes, particularly with the 1996 Telecommunications Act that eviscerated a lot of radio ownership rules. Like Sinclair, Clear Channel took advantage of those changes to grow into the largest radio station owner in American history. At its peak, Clear Channel owned about 1,200 radio stations nationwide. Like Sinclair, Clear Channel was a favorite home for right-wing media bombast. Like the largest, and it was the largest broadcast outlet for Rush Limbaugh, and served as the spawning ground for another right-wing media darling who, under Clear Channel's auspices, organized pro-war rallies in the run-up to the 2003 war in Iraq, a DJ in Cincinnati by the name of Glenn Beck. Like Sinclair, Clear Channel sought to grow even bigger with further media rule changes. And like Sinclair, Clear Channel was blocked from its ambitions with the 2003 media ownership rule rewrite that was halted by popular outcry and organizing. But what's happened to Clear Channel ever since? In the short, a staggered collapse. First, Clear Channel became the poster child of media consolidation gone amok and hemorrhaged listeners who began to turn away. Clear Channel proceeded to then sell off a third of its own radio stations and sought to rehabilitate its brand given the infamy associated with the name Clear Channel, so it changed its name. It became iHeartRadio, and its larger complex of media properties became iHeartMedia. The former Clear Channel continued to lose prominence nonetheless, and also audience, thanks to internet streaming options, an increase in low-power FM radio community broadcasters, and a renaissance of podcasts. The former Clear Channel raised the money to buy its radio stations when it went on this buying spree, largely due to loans. And now debtors were demanding payments in return, but Clear Channel / iHeartMedia was increasingly unable to pay because it lost audience share. Facing lawsuits from creditors in March 2018, the former Clear Channel / iHeartMedia filed for bankruptcy. And the amount of money it is due to pay had been $20 billion, but was able to reduce that in bankruptcy proceedings to $10 billion. If you were a creditor for Clear Channel, that sucks for you, because that meant that you would probably not never get paid. The debt to cash flow ratio, the amount of money coming in to the amount of debt it has, is 13 to 1. For every dollar it has $13 of debt. Yeah. It's in a real bind, and just 15 years when it was thought it could rule the world and probably won't be able to escape from the bind that it's in, deservedly so. Could the same thing happen to Sinclair? The first of those prospects has happened. Sinclair was blocked on a slam dunk deal that everyone, even its opponents, thought would happen. But TV, unlike radio, remains the main source of news for most Americans. Now, that may change given the inroads that internet usage is making, but the problem with that is that you're trading one devil for another, or worse, the two may feed off each other. The biggest companies on the internet use ceaseless digital surveillance as their business model. In fact, upwards of two-thirds of all digital advertising dollars is held by just two companies, Google and Facebook. As more of local journalism gets eroded through the departure of advertising dollars, probably to Google and Facebook, Sinclair is well poised to fill in that gap. And not in a good way. Other options, therefore, are needed to break this bondage. In the short term, one proposal to advocate for may be to make American journalism, particularly local journalism, a nonprofit enterprise. In some respects, it's already on its way to doing that, given the erosion of advertising dollars from newspapers. Journalism could be funded by other initiatives. For example, one proposal from economist Dean Baker would allow taxpayers to take up to $150 off their taxes and use that money to donate to the nonprofit, non-commercial media outlet of your choice. That could, by some estimates, free up billions of dollars of money for a more healthy media sector in the United States. But in the longer term, we have to think about and critically not be afraid to think about alternatives for orienting our economy and economic relations into something far more humane. This is something that gets precious little discussion, and if I could be so bold to offer a suggestion to the forum committee, this might be the subject for a future topic that I may want to talk about. Hint, hint. But anyway, that in a summary is Sinclair and Tribune and a little capsule taste of media activism and how it can make a difference and has. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to your questions and comments. Thank you. We have a question. Yes. Yes. Their question is about, I'm going to repeat the question to make sure it gets recorded on both the computer and another broadcast. I'm asked about Politico. How is it funded and how does it work? Politico, for folks who may not know, is a, I had a friend who used to work for Politico. It is a DC-based outlet that covers politics, especially a lot of the day-to-day grind of federal politics. It's funded largely, I'm good, thank you. It's funded largely through conventional advertising. It actually has a fairly standard business model where it actually just raises ads and also one other thing it does have is it has a funding stream where it actually pays a premium version for people usually on the know within DC who can afford it. So in addition to, yes, you could go to politico.com and view their standard articles from the day, and all you have to do is just put up with a few ads to pay for that. It's mostly on the internet. There is a print version, but they also have a premium version that's actually quite expensive with a lot of nitty-gritty guest gossip behind that. And there will be people who will pay for that, and that also to an extent helps to pay for that service. So, yeah, the short answer is it's nothing all that unconventional. It's still a business, run kind of a business model, significant chunk by advertising, but a more significant chunk through a premium service. Other questions? Yes?
Yeah, I was curious what you mentioned, Glenn Beck. And doesn't he have a station, Blaze?
Mm-hmm.
Did that come out of, thank you, Clear?
I'm asked about the point that I had raised with Glenn Beck and the origins of his network and television station, The Blaze. Glenn Beck had been, after Clear Channel, he was a commenter on CNN, actually, Headline News. Then he was had a very big, and that was where he became a national name, a TV show on Fox News. And but that ran for 3 or 4 years, and he felt like Fox was actually not right-wing enough. And so he thought, well, forget you guys, I'll start my own. And so we actually started his own premium channel where you can pay, I think, $9.99 a month. And you can get a subscription to The Blaze, which is his outlet where he pontificates for 2 or 3 hours a day. He points you to various outlets where you can supposedly learn more. He connects in with other connections with other like-minded folks. And the fact that it's also a kind of premium model, you have to pay it, and it's and on occasion he'll post like a little chunk here or there to post online. But by and large, that's also a premium model. His thing was that he just felt like it wasn't right-wing enough. And so he thought he could do better on his own. And so that's what he wound up doing. Yeah. How is he doing? It's reasonably thriving? I actually not entirely sure. As the station is still around, it's enough of a business model that he can sustain it to some degree. I don't think it's had the kind of explosive growth, but I don't think he wants that. Or it's like he's trying to, but it hasn't taken off. But it's sustainable. He's built he's been able to build an audience and keep it going, and he's probably making, whatever, 7 figures a year or something like that. Yes?
Can you talk about Sinclair ownership in the Chicago area?
I'm asked about Sinclair ownership in the Chicago area. At the moment, Sinclair has no ownership in the Chicago area. In fact, had the deal with Tribune gone through, it would have had its first outlet in Chicago. It would have bought WGN. The problem with that is that it would have tried to do that in a very suspicious way. It was trying to actually get WGN through a sidecar agreement. It actually wouldn't buy, Sinclair wouldn't buy WGN outright. It would actually sell it to a Chicago guy, a gentleman who actually works as a car dealer, but who happens to be friends with David Smith, and who would basically be, it has a name, as I mentioned it. It's a sidecar agreement. The idea was that Mr. Car Dealer would have bought it, and after all the paperwork was done, and maybe 3 or 4 months after that to make things cool down, they would just transfer the paperwork. So short answer is no, there's no ownership. WGN would have been the first and probably would have been a told. It might not have been the last.
But you said that they got rid of the prohibitions on sidecar agreements, so it still could happen?
The sidecar agreements, the timetable of that was that you could have sidecar agreements. Then there was a crackdown during the Obama years with Tom Wheeler, who said, I don't want sidecar agreements. I cracked down on it. Now, ostensibly, they are back because, you know, anything goes in this current FCC with Ajit Pai in charge. But the problem, though, is that I think there was enough heat on the FCC that they couldn't just let them get away with it. Because when you actually read the FCC's objection, you can find it online. I did. I have a copy. They actually cited the sidecar agreements as a reason and a big reason why they reject the deal. So, yeah. But policy-wise, nothing has changed. The only thing that has changed is that a lot more heat is on Sinclair and people are speaking out and know about it. That's why this matters. Yes, question.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the role the public played in this, but I mean, it kind of surprised me that there wasn't more of a fear about that. I mean, it seemed like all the employees at the WGN were afraid to say anything because they might get fired after Sinclair took over. And pretty much, you know, there was some coverage nationally of the issue, but there wasn't a lot of coverage, it didn't seem to me, or there weren't any, and no citizen, you know, no mass protests or anything like this. I wondered, though, too, like, I mean, if they actually promulgated that right-wing perspective on WGN, I mean, would it lose market share because do people really want to watch this?
Right, right. There's a lot there to unpack. Whether or not that there was actually a lot of protest on that, the thing is, comments to the FCC matter. It may not seem like it, but it matters, especially when it reaches a threshold. Every media merger that has been blocked has gotten at least 1 million comments about that. That's what actually happened with the buyout of Comcast and Comcast's proposed buyout of Time Warner Cable. That actually got blocked because people spoke out. If you look through history, a lot of this, you need to have those comments reach that threshold. It certainly did in the media ownership rule, where it actually reached the million threshold for the first time ever back in 2003. By the time the dust settled, they estimate about 3 million people commented out. By FCC comparative standards, 5,000 people is a lot. And yet it reached 3 million. That had never happened before. And that was breathtaking. And people noticed that, especially people on Capitol Hill and also in the judiciary. When the courts in 2003 blocked the media ownership rules that the FCC had approved, they actually, the prosecution that was trying to defeat those media ownership rule changes presented the fact that millions of people had commented to the FCC using the FCC's own records as evidence. And the courts noticed that and said, look, 1 million people, more like 3 million people, 1 million people spoke out about this. Shouldn't that matter? And the courts believed that it did. And that's why they blocked it. And that's why this was stopped. And that's why, you know, WGN and why Tribune basically went into bankruptcy, you know, had a collapse, had a change of ownership, cleaved into two, and why Tribune, why Sinclair thought, ooh, right target, I can buy this out, because they're on the downswing, we're on the upswing. But yet, when people spoke out, it might matter. It might not be the kind of thing where you have, you know, necessarily pickets. We actually saw a picket on our way here downtown. There were still labor strikes outside of Marriott Hotels going on. They actually signed out to, some contracts got signed, so some of those strikes are over and they were able to get a contract.
They were drummers.
Yes, I know. They were drummers. They sometimes do that. Yep.
Out.
Yep. So it might not be as dramatic at that, but don't let the fact that when people do things, it doesn't have an impact. It does. It might not be as dramatic, but and especially where, you know, these kinds of things don't usually have the kind of presentation because they don't have the kind of oomph that like something positive had. Like if the 2003 media ownership rule changes had gone through, you would have noticed it like in a matter of months after that because you would have noticed like, wow, like two companies own all the media in the United States. How did this happen? And then I have to explain, well, this is how it happened. And the part of the reason why was because you were asleep. Yes?
Yeah, it seems to me like we've got two problems. One is the door being thrown open to this consolidation, which has got to be bad. Own all the media in the United States. And the other is that the takeover targets every operator in this business, it seems, your Tronks and your everybody else, has less and less commitment to news or information or informing the public. And they're slashing local news, especially. They're laying off reporters. And they, you know, what makes their money is
I'm asked regarding the prioritization of media and particularly news-oriented outlets to dismiss news because it's cheaper and more profitable to not do news. I should say this is not a trend that is new, and certainly well before the internet came to prominence and to social media coming to prominence. This is not a new trend. I mean, I could have given the same presentation absent a lot of the recent developments in 1999 on the complaints on they're prioritizing fluff, they're cutting down news, they're cutting down coverage, they're reducing outlets, they're laying off journalists, and the same complaints would still hold water. Yeah. The problem, though, is that this is the way the business works. They are oriented and have been practically since, you could count it all the way back to maybe like 1910. There was a very vibrant newspaper scene in the United States. A city maybe the size of St. Louis, circa 1890, had probably 15 daily newspapers. The problem was that increasingly newspapers relied on advertising as a source of revenue. And by virtue of that fact, they wound up actually consolidating or driving people out because then there became a competition for those advertising dollars. That would mean that, you know, a newspaper, you'd have maybe 15 daily newspapers, all of whom would have, you know, they'd be open regarding their own political persuasion. And you could just, you know, you say, I like that one, I don't like that one. But at least with 15 different options, you'd have a choice and probably some reasonable diversity of perspectives. When you're down to one or two, right, and then they do the same thing, you feel like, wait a minute, this is really explicit, and there are no other, you know, newspaper options.
Yeah, I was thinking of what happened with DNA Info, which was the online outlet that had become like totally vital for people in a number of cities to actually get some frickin' local news, and the owners seemed to have shut it down.
And they did shut it down. No. They shut it down precisely because they were, the people on staff were trying to organize. They were trying to organize, and it was, in fact, it, like some activists referred to that by the term kind of like Marxist connotations, but I think it's accurate, a capital strike. Yeah. The ownership said, I am not going to let this ownership, I'm not going to let this organizing happen. You don't dare to bring a labor union into this. I'm going to shut you down. End of story. The website that day went dead. They actually later brought back the archives because they were nice. So you can actually read some of the previous journalism there. But they killed the outlet because they didn't want that to happen. And that's a pretty extreme example. But, you know, it shows the indicative of the game that we're playing. And it's a serious fight here. But people have been fighting it for quite a while. And also, we need to think of new ways to orient our economic relations. Hint, hint. Like I said, this is the kind of thing that we could discuss. I can write another 4,000 word presentation and just ask. Other questions?
I was
going to
bring
up.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to ask. I'm ignorant on where this Pi person came from.
Ajit Pai, you mean?
Right.
So I'm asked about the history of Ajit Pai. Ajit Pai, spelled P-A-I, is a... His history is he was born in Kansas. He actually has a connection locally. He actually got his JD from the University of Chicago. For what it's worth, I hold 2 degrees in the University of Chicago myself. So don't let that necessarily fool you. He then nevertheless went on to become a connected political regarding media ownership. He actually worked as a lawyer and a lobbyist for Verizon for a number of years. He was then, appointed as a commissioner to the FCC under Tom Wheeler. He was one of the, you know, right-wing goons on the FCC for a bit. And then when the way that the FCC works is the majority of the ownership of the commission coincides with the political party that holds the White House. So during the Obama years, you had a majority of Democrats. Now during the Trump years, you have a majority of Republicans. And so they needed a chair. They said, okay, Ajit Pai, congratulations, you're now chair, and he's been chair now a little more than 2 years. And so, but he's been basically pretty extreme and wants to eviscerate a lot of things. To his credit and to my surprise, he actually stopped this by the Tribune, but that was probably because he was getting the heat. And not only that, also I didn't mention this in the presentation, he got heat from the FCC's own inspector general who was investigating this and was just like, you're in bed with this too. you could be held liable. And that might be another reason why he probably killed this deal, because he might have been found as being implicated. Everybody. I'm sorry.
If it's a short one.
Okay, just an update on net neutrality. I said, is that on the chopping block right now, or is that
I'm asked about an update on net neutrality, and I'll have to do it in about a minute or so. The short summary is that as far as the official statute, net neutrality is dead. The FCC, by a 3-1 vote, there are only one Democrat and the commissioner at the moment, voted to abolish net neutrality in its entirety. Not even like any kind of watered-down version, it's dead. This was back in late December of last year. Nevertheless, there have been a lot of people who have been speaking out about it. This is now the new record holder for the most commented issue in FCC history. 22 million comments it has gotten. That's going to matter because that's going to be brought to, and this is now in court now. Popular movements are bringing this into court. There is actually a very good chance they will win because they've got alignments regarding local configurations that could find conflicts of interest with the FCC, as well as pointing out violations the FCC had in its own statute for actually following through on its policy. The FCC broke its own rules to get this ruling through, and they will probably lose in court on this. We'll probably find out, like, end of the year, I think. Maybe early next year. We'll see. But, yeah, it's we're fighting that, too.
So,
thank you.
So, I want to thank you for an incredible presentation.
You're very welcome. Thank you for coming, and thank you for listening.
We will welcome you back. We'll be
I will be thrilled to come back.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm so glad you all were here to hear it this morning. Really spectacular. And a big thank you to Johanna. I think this was your idea. No, or Laurel's idea to have him this morning. So next week there is no forum. The following week will be Social Action Sunday. And if there was ever a little testament about social action, we sure heard it today. So the first Sunday in October will be Social Action Sunday. And I welcome you back for that. So now let's head upstairs for service, and I hope you all have wonderful weeks. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Good to
see
you.
I didn't see you in a million years. Oh, my God.
That's quite all right.
Mentoring a guy.
I can see why you were so excited.
This morning,
oh, my God. No,
he's getting
that's okay.
Days,
I've got audio if you want it.
So I'm so glad that you
yeah.